This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
I'm Stephen Henderson, and this is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm here in the studio with our producer, Kerry Jr. II. So, question. If you're locked out of a mainstream economy, how do you make sure that you can provide economic stability or even prosperity? And if you're talking about an entire community, how does that work? That's the question at the center of our conversation today.
And what means are you willing to go to find that, right? Like, what are the types of ways? This isn't just getting a job. This isn't just going to school.
Right. This is inventing something that will put money in your pocket and food on the table and a roof over your head. Felicia George is an anthropology professor at Wayne State University, and she's written a book about this. It's called When Detroit Played the Numbers. And the numbers for a long time for African Americans and some other communities was the way that you did all of those things, that you provided stability and got to prosperity outside the mainstream economy.
Okay, so Stephen, help me understand.
I know of it.
I've heard about playing the numbers. I know it's related to the lottery, but I know it's different in some ways.
It's like a precursor of the lottery, right? It's where the lottery comes from. It's this idea of picking three numbers every day, a series of three numbers, and deciding that that's your number for the day. And then there's a drawing at the end of the day. Now, of course, with the lottery, it's an actual drawing. With the numbers, there was a pretty inventive way to figure out what the number would be, but equally random. And if you hit, you got money. But the people who were involved in this, the scale of this business was so big that it had this incredible economic effect on the Black community. And in this book, Felicia George writes about what that meant in Detroit. I'm really looking forward to the conversation. And the work here is absolutely stellar in its detail and its narrative. So let's get to Felicia George talking about when Detroit played the numbers. Felicia George, welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you for having me.
So we were talking before we started the interview about how everybody has a story about the numbers, and that is especially true in Detroit, right?
Yes, everyone has
a story about a family member or a neighbor. So let's start with some just basic definitions. For people who maybe haven't heard these stories, what is the numbers, and why is it such an important part of Black history in Detroit?
You know, it's really funny. Playing the numbers is just simply a game of chance. Today's daily three Michigan lottery stole it from the numbers, which came here in Detroit in probably about 1919, 1920. And you're right, everybody has a story to tell about it. But what's so interesting about the numbers is as you track it over history and time, you see how it helped shape history. It's not just a game that, you know, people play. It was so much more than that. Mm-hmm. It was a way for neighbors to come together in solidarity. It was a way for, at a time when Blacks were not afforded the opportunity to get loans, for them to get loans. It financed business. It financed education. I mean, it did so much in the city of Detroit for the Black community when the formal economy shut down and was not very receptive to having Blacks in that realm.
Right. Like, this is like so much that's part of our culture. It grows out of discrimination, but we took it and made it into things that would work for us in ways that that mainstream economic systems were not. Let's explain to people how it worked.
Okay. So every numbers organization had their own unique ticket. So it was either, say, Yellow Dog or Big Four, and that's how you knew what organization you were playing with. And so that was another, you know, checks and balance that kind of took place. So what would happen is you would go to your numbers writer, and you would say, for example, I want to play the number 801, and I want to box it. And boxing it means that any combination of that number, if it falls, you win. You're a winner. So if it fell 108 or 018, you were the winner.
And that's something that still works at the horse racing track, right? I mean, I'm somebody who spent 3 years living in Kentucky, betting on horses,
you can put
it in a box. Now you don't win as much money
exactly.
If you put it in a box as if you just play it straight. But you can say I want it in this order or that order or whatever order.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And what was important was who decided what racetracks that was going to be the winning numbers. And so there was power in that. And so you would say, for instance, you know, I want it to be the Downs racetrack. And when you would actually place your bet, you would tell your numbers writer, I'm playing the first three races or the last three races. And what that means is what the paper would print was the mutuals paid. What was the payout for that race? So, for example, the first race that would run, let's say, for instance, the payout was $18.90. The second race comes out and it's $77.50. And then the third race was like $114. How they would pick the winning number was you would look at those totals that were paid out. The first number in the decimal point is the number you're looking at. So for the first race, if that first number was a 8 in front of the decimal point, that was the first number that fell. The second race, if the first number in that decimal point was a 7, that's what fell. And then for the third race, if that number was a 4 in a decimal point, that's it. You've got your three digits. So you would open up the paper and you would go on this particular day, the first three races, the number in front of the decimal point was 874. And if you played 874, you won.
Yeah. And your writer would come back to you with the money. You didn't have to like go get it and tell them, hey, I hit. They knew you hit.
They knew you hit. Yeah.
And,
yes.
And a lot of them were good in the sense that they didn't even have to write it down. Right. They knew they had the numbers in their head.
There were some people that had those great memories that they could memorize numbers. And it was actually a benefit to that. If you were good enough where you could memorize the numbers, you didn't have to worry about as much as getting caught by the police because you don't have number slips.
That's right. That's right. How does that end up doing all the things that you were talking about? How does it end up making it possible for people to get money? How does it finance businesses? How does that all work?
So, you know, you think about it, the bets could be as small as a penny or a nickel, but those pennies and nickels add up because a lot of people are playing. And one thing about us here in Detroit, we're hustlers, we're innovative, and we're all about, you know, being there for each other, uplifting the community. And so I have to take a minute and say who the father of numbers was here in Detroit. It was John Roxborough. Mm-hmm. And you may think, oh, that name sounds familiar. And it should, because he was the manager of Joe Louis. Mm-hmm. And he came from a very elite family where his father was an attorney and it was expected that he would become an attorney. And he said, no, that's not for me. I'm not going to waste my time going to law school. And then they tell me the only job I can get is a porter or a janitor. And so instead, he went a different route. He worked for the post office for a while, and then he became a bail bondsman. And one day he was bailing out someone from Kansas City who was a numbers man. And he said, you know what? I notice you guys do not have numbers here or policy here in Detroit. You've got all this money coming in from the Ford plant, all these black people. You can make a killing. And so he listened to him. He learned from him. And then he started the numbers. And so what he would do is he would mingle his illegal gains that he got from the numbers into legitimate businesses, mm-hmm. funding Joe Louis, funding insurance companies. And that money just grew and grew and grew.
Yeah. Talk about how big this was in Detroit. When we say everybody was doing it, that's almost a literal description.
Yes. You have to think about the times. You know, here this is in the 1920s when the Depression has hit 1929 and money is tight and people are out of work. But I'm going to tell you who had money. The numbers men had money. They had a lot of money. And some of those guys were making, and if you think about it, 1920, 1929, they were making $10,000 a day profit. That was paying stuff out. So it was quite a bit. And so those pennies really, really added up.
You know, there's something about the idea of giving someone your money and hoping for something that is charming and, as you say, was kind of a cultural phenomenon. But isn't there something about it that's also exploitative.
You know what? I say this from the beginning. When I wrote this book, when I did my dissertation, I am not here to say that it was perfect because it wasn't. And I've heard people talk about, yes, it was exploitative.
But what about that balance, right?
You know what? There was a balance. And let me tell you where the balance came in at. These guys, yes, they made money. They were Americans. This is all about capitalism. This is what we do. And so they made their money, but they gave back to the community. This was truly reciprocity at its best. What I really liked about these old school numbers operators were they knew corporate social responsibility before it became a thing. Mm. They were doing it long before then. They knew that in order for them to make money, in order for the community to support them, they had to support the community. So they made sure that, you know, when people were hungry, that they were fed. They made sure that at Christmas times, kids had Christmas baskets. They would do things like when they knew times were really rough in the neighborhood, they would tell them, wink, wink, pay this number. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only pay it for so much, but play this number. And miraculously, that number would fall. And so it would be nice
because a little bit of an insider just thing. Just a little bit of an insider thing. Right?
Just to kind of help them out, just so that they could limp along a little bit more.
Yeah. Let's talk about the cultural dimension of it as well, bringing people into contact with their neighbors. So, I mean, in some ways, you have to get people now to forget all of the things that make life convenient for us, and then imagine a citywide activity that depends on communication, right?
Yes.
I've got to tell somebody what my number is for the day. They've got to take that and remember what it is and make sure that if I hit, I get paid. This was an enormous social interaction. You had to go find the numbers person, or he had to find you. They would go to barbershops, they would go to beauty shops, they would go to garage, wherever, to find people to get those numbers.
And it was, you explained it beautifully. This truly was a machine, the way it worked.
Yeah.
And each numbers operator, they had their own little organization. So John Roxborough's, his was the Big Four. His buddy's was Everett Watson. His was called the Yellow Dog. And they would hire literally hundreds of writers to hit those streets.
Right.
And the writers had great relationships with their customers. These writers sometimes were so good, they knew what their customers would play all the time. Because some people, you know, they really, really are married to a certain number. But they would go out in full force and they would go to their customers, or their customers would come to them at various locations. And then after this exchange of numbers happened, then you had another level. So the writer had to turn it to the pickup man. And then the pickup man had to take it to headquarters. And then headquarters had to have checkers checking the numbers and recording them. And then when it fell, they had to make sure they were paying the people the correct amount and putting them in envelopes. And so this was a huge machine, a huge business, but the social aspect can never really be truly measured because, you know, you got these relationships with your numbers writer.
Yeah.
And you would talk to them and you would gossip and you would, you know, hear about who was in politics and what was going on in school. I mean, it would touch on so many things. And at one point, the numbers man really figured out, we can really work these relationships. And so they got a lot of political clout with politicians at the time who were not doing anything for Black people.
Yeah.
And they would say, hey, you know, I can get this area to vote for you. What are you going to do for the Black community?
Right.
And so this was more than just, you know, socializing and hanging
out. It became like a lobbying interest.
Yes, it was. Right? It was.
Wow. Wow. I love the terms with things like this, right? I mean, they start out with one thing and then they, you know, the culture takes them and makes them something else. But you're using that word writer in a really interesting way. And I say that as someone who's made his life in writing and as a journalist. But that's what they were. They were the numbers writers.
Yes.
The ones who took your number.
Yes.
Yeah. And that could be anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It could be the man that was cutting your hair. It could be the woman that was doing your laundry. It could literally be anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. This is at a time when African Americans are not welcome in lots of other parts of the economy. It's why this grows up. Talk about how it changes Black business, though, and the Black economy that grows up in Detroit, in places like Paradise Valley, for instance, where most Black businesses were.
So I gotta go down two avenues. I'm going to talk a little bit about the business, but I also want to talk about the professional aspect of it.
Yeah.
So this is a huge organization. It's a huge machine. You had to have an attorney you know, because if they got caught, you needed somebody to go to court and defend right. you. You had to have accountants because this is a lot of money in a community. And so they had to have a way to account for this and a way to pay their people. You had to have cashiers. You had to have people that had these skills. And so at one point when you have someone that I went to school and I'm Black and I went to school to be an attorney. Mm. And I can't get hired at a law firm. Mm. I can't get hired by Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. But who can I hire? Who will hire me? The numbers man.
The numbers man.
And I had a good job with them. So that was one aspect that really turned around that these people that normally wouldn't have gotten received any kind of chance to be an attorney or an accountant, they now were able to really work in their professional bellywick that they had went out there for. And so it was a really, really big deal.
Yeah.
And then when we talk about the business aspect, again, the formal economy was not allowing us to borrow money to open up a barbershop or to have an insurance company. We had to figure out how to come up with this money.
Yeah.
And so these numbers men had all of this money, and that's what they did.
Access to capital.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
One of the numbers men that I talk about is Everett Watson. He came out with his own loan business. And so he's loaning money to people for housing. And at one point, when we couldn't even find houses in Detroit, he started building housing. And none of this would have been possible without those pennies and nickels that came from the Black community.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, the numbers goes away, as you say, because basically it gets co-opted by the state.
Yeah.
The lottery system that we know today really replaces it. Talk about what happens, though, to such a big part of the economy when government essentially says, no, we can do this better.
We can do it better, and we like the profits.
And we like the profits, right.
It really became devastating in a lot of senses. Once the lottery became legal, you start seeing a decline even before it was legalized. Urban renewal came through, and it really hurt the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
It displaced people, and so the communities were not close-knit anymore. And so that was the first blow. The second blow came when the government came in and said, hey, we're going to be the ultimate takeover, mm-hmm. and they took it over. And so at that point, you still had people that were hanging on to it, that were still doing the illegal numbers. They would just use, and it wasn't until 1977 that the government figured out, we need to do this three-digit thing because it makes money. They would still do their informal or illegal lottery. But you start seeing it really, really dissipate and go away from the communities because the communities were not the same anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And when you saw that, you start seeing that, this money that was there for Black businesses, it started kind of draining away a little bit. And at one point, the biggest place that you could still find the numbers were in automotive plants.
Yes.
And so that just shows you it goes from a community-based activity to now it's in the automotive plants, which I can argue that that's a community in itself.
It is, right. But it's interesting to hear you connect the demise of the numbers with the things that we are now all of a sudden talking about again, which mm-hmm. is the demise of these communities, right? Black
right.
Bottom, Paradise Valley.
Yes.
We know that they go away in large part because of government decisions about redevelopment, about highway construction and things like that. But the numbers and the takeover, really, of the numbers also is one of the things that fuels that demise.
Yes, it was a death blow. At this point in time, there were a couple of things that kind of put us down this weird road where it was kind of getting pulled from the Black community. At one point, you had mostly the Black community was supporting and playing the numbers, probably about the 20s and 30s. And then in the 30s, all of a sudden, the mob realized, uh-oh, there's money to be had in here.
We want some, too.
We want some, too. And so the Italian mob, the Jewish mob, they got involved, had their own operations. But what's really weird about them, they were still very segregated.
Mm-hmm.
So you had Blacks playing with the Black numbers men, Polish playing with the Polish. And so it was still very segregated. And then here we come to 1960s. And we are now losing a little control because the power came in, the person who had the ability to pick where the racetrack was going to be the winning track.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of lost that ability in the 1940s when John Roxborough went to prison. And so that's a different story. And so the mob at that point started getting a whole lot more power and strength. And as they started getting power and strength and we got urban renewal coming, they figured out we want some of this black business too. Yeah. And so they got smart. They did a hostile takeover. And what they did was they would lure the writers and the pickup men from the black numbers organizations and pay them more money. Yeah. And so you can't run a numbers business if you don't have, you know, employees. Sure. And so we had all of these things that were happening behind the scenes that kind of led to numbers really losing a lot of its power in the black community.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Felicia George about her work about the numbers here in the city of Detroit. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Created Equal, and we're talking with Felicia George, who's a professor of anthropology at Wayne State University and author of a book titled When Detroit Played the Numbers. I want to talk about the numbers in a sort of broader cultural context. African-Americans aren't the only ones who had to turn to, let's call them extra-legal activities. Yes. In order to make money because they were locked out of mainstream economies. Now, the reasons are all different for different groups. But talk about how the numbers sort of travel with and relate to some of those other things that the Jewish community was doing, or Italians or Irish people who also were told, hey, this isn't really for you.
You know, it's interesting you say that. There's a theory called ethnic secession that says that as new groups come from, new ethnic groups come from overseas to the United States, we've got this whole little ladder, this little pyramid where you start at the bottom, and then when another ethnic group comes in, then that ethnic group is no longer at the bottom. They get pushed up a little bit higher. And so you're right. These other ethnic groups were locked out just like black people were. The Polish, be it the Irish, be it the Jewish, all had to struggle when they came here to the United States. So they come here and, you know, rum running was a huge thing. When Prohibition hit, yes. You saw a lot of here in Detroit, the Purple Gang, which were Jewish. They ran the rum. You saw the Italians get into that as well. And with numbers, what was really interesting, it started out where it was really, really predominantly in the black community. But then those other ethnic groups start seeing, hey, there's money to be made
right.
in this.
And they start doing it themselves. We were talking about that, right?
Yes. And what was really interesting about this as well, there's a little story that I talk about in the book where one of the numbers men is walking down the street. And he sees an Asian man, and he says, hey, what do you have in there? And he says, oh, you know, I've got black people dreams. And so then he runs into this Asian man sometime later, and he says, hey, what do you have in your bag? And he said, Asian folks have black dreams, too. So it was just, it's this little, you know, anecdote that goes around, this little joke that goes around about how, you know, this wasn't just within the black community. Other communities, other ethnic groups took it and made it their own, be it first starting out running rum, doing that illegally, getting involved in some of the union busting. You know, each ethnic group did what they had to do to kind of grow their wealth and to obtain their American dream.
Yeah. And similar to other dynamics in our society, a lot of those other groups are able to make more for themselves out of this than African Americans, because the reasons they were locked out were very different from the reason that we were locked out. You know, I say all the time, you're black your whole life in America. And that means something.
Yes. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that. As that whole ethnic secession kind of goes through, and as more people start coming in and more people are at the bottom and those people at the top rise, we kind of forget at one point that, you know, oh, the Polish were not thought very highly at one point. Mm-hmm. But we don't think about that today. But today, you know, we can't shed our black skin. Right. And so that's something that we can't overcome or grow. One of the things things that you saw a lot too during that time period was the changing of last names so that your last name wasn't very ethnic sounding.
Sure.
We didn't have that luxury to do that in black.
It can't be less black.
It can't be less black. But you would see things like that. You know, now that I'm trying to go legitimate, I started out doing something in the informal underground economy. And now I want to be a legitimate businessman. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to change my name a little bit so that it's more American, that it doesn't have this ethnic ring to it. And so not to say they didn't have a struggle, because they did. It was just their struggle was different. And in some ways, they were able to overcome it a lot faster because of that.
Yeah. And at the same time, some of what they're able to do happens at the expense of what African Americans were trying to do for ourselves.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You want to say that, you know, they're taking on some of the techniques and some of the things and some of the jobs and some of the businesses that Black people had created. But you're absolutely right, because even when we have these businesses, we're still locked out in mainstream society.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have the advantage of having support in mainstream society, not only can you now take our business or lock Black people's business out, but you're able to, you know, elevate just because you have that support of being part of mainstream society.
Right, right. There's also, I think, the disparate way that criminal justice thinks of these kinds of activities, depending on who's involved. And the police interest, for instance, in things like the numbers, focus a little more on Black folks than other people as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, it was really interesting to me how for years the media, law enforcement, portrayed the numbers and the lottery as just being just horrible. When you look at some of the newspaper articles that they were tales of warning to tell people, don't play the numbers. You know, it was, they would talk about it. Yeah, it's really dangerous. One of the things I thought was really interesting, when Nixon became president, you know, one of the things that he was talking about, and this is, you know, years later, he put playing the numbers right up there with drugs.
With drugs.
And so you look at this, you go, how do we compare this? And so for all these years, it's such an evil institution until the government decides that it's not. And so then the narrative right. switches. And at times, you know, you look at some of the arrest records of the people that were involved in the numbers. These are people that the only sin they had was trying to make a dollar, trying to, you know, get that American dream by, you know, being in the numbers business. They don't have any other record whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And so it at times it really did become focused as a way to control, you know, the masses.
Yeah. At the same time, it does in every community, because it's a legal activity, it runs alongside these other illegal activities. And there's a connection between some of the things that we see African Americans still having to resort to because of that past discrimination and current that are related to the numbers that are not as innocent in the effect that they have on our community.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. You know, it's funny. I was speaking with someone and we were talking about the whole issue now with the legalization of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
I see the parallels big time between that and what happened when the lottery became legal.
Say more about that, about how— For years, African Americans have been targeted, I think mm-hmm. is right, the right word, yes. By the criminal justice system for our involvement in the drug trade and selling marijuana, everything from marijuana all the way up to much harder drugs. Now, all of a sudden, we've decided that's legal, and there is no look back at, okay, well, what about all these people we put in jail or whose lives we ruined because of that?
Yeah, you know, and it's really, really, it's a sad commentary, and you know how it's going to play out, because you can just look at what happened with the numbers, and I'll switch back to the marijuana in a second.
Yeah.
But with the numbers, the media went after it. It was horrible. The politicians went out that it was horrible. You had law enforcement going after it. It was horrible. And they painted these pictures. And then when they decided it was legal— One of the things that they did was that I thought was really, really interesting. They said, we have to make sure we have representation in the Black community. And so we're going to see if we can get some lottery agents. Those are, you know, your numbers writers.
Right.
We're going to get us, make
now
sure
they're
we
called
have
lottery agents.
Lottery agents. We want to make sure that they are representative in the Black community. So I fast forward and I think to the whole issue with marijuana. Mm-hmm. What did they do? The exact same thing. Once it became legalized, it was like, okay, we have to make sure that we're going to represent these people who before, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but saying before, these were the people that were dealing marijuana at one point and, you know, maybe got in some trouble. So we have to make sure that we're opening this up for the community, mm-hmm. for this area, the people who were doing this for years, that they're not locked out of it.
Yeah.
And so those parallels are just really interesting to me.
Yeah. I mean, and it says something about, I think, the broader imbalances that we still have to fight in this society, which is, yeah. you know, I mean, it's everywhere, but I'm not sure people put together that that things like the numbers or things like legalization of marijuana speak to those inequalities.
Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Let's talk a little more about in Detroit. What replaces that cultural connection that the numbers gave us? Or does that become permanently damaged when that goes away? Of course, I think it's really interesting to think about those things now because so much communication and community looks so different
yes.
because of technology. And every day there's something that my children, for instance, are doing that brings them closer in some ways to people. But I always feel like it also pushes them further away because it's not like something like the numbers. We don't have anything like that.
No, we don't. Sadly, when the numbers went away, that relationship, that reciprocity, that sense of community kind of went away as well. And you start seeing it even before we hit to today's days with our cell phones. I mean, when the telephones came into play, you can now call your number in. When fax machines came into play.
Yeah.
So it just kept growing and growing and growing where that whole sense of community, you know, the numbers writers don't have to go to door to door anymore. I can just pick up a phone and you know, tell me what it is. And today I can just text it to you. But what's really interesting about it is there are still pockets where people hold on to that sense of community. Go to any corner store right before drawing time and you will see—
And the lottery, with the official lottery.
The official lottery. And you will see pockets of people that are there trying to hurry up and get their numbers in. Mm-hmm. And they're talking to each other. And they're like, what are you playing? And, you know, what is your dream? And so you still see it in little pockets, but not like it was before, not where it's totally in the neighborhood. So it is a sense of community that we've lost.
Yeah. And what about the economic part of that? What happens to that? Does it all transfer to other illegal activity? Or do we see parts of the Black business community that in some way at least owe their existence and vitality to the numbers?
You know, I think it's both, to be honest. I think sometimes, you know, when people are out trying to get their hustle on, trying to realize their American right. dream, and they realize, you know what, this avenue is closed, so I'm going to do another avenue to do it. And so you would see it kind of switch from that to maybe something else illegal. But there are legacies of where people would not be who they are now
sure.
if it were not for that money that was made in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And so there still are some Black businesses that can raise their hand and wave
yeah,
and say—
Yeah, talk about who that is.
Yeah. Like, so, you know, I don't want to put people on
yeah,
blast.
Right, right, right. Can't get anybody
but,
in trouble.
But I will say, and it's someone that I consider a friend, mm-hmm. Bridget Davis, she wrote a book
yes.
about her mother.
She was a guest on the old show we had on WDET Detroit Today.
Yes, wonderful
about
woman.
How her mom made it
yes.
through. By being part of the numbers.
Yes. And so because she wrote a book about it, I feel okay to say. But she's a great example of it. She will tell you it was generational wealth, that's what her mom did. Her mom set her up.
Yeah.
You know, her mom paid for that education that she got, and she is doing wonderful, and she has a legacy that she has because of her mother, and she's leaving that legacy for her children.
Yeah.
And so there are, you know, spots where, you know, that legacy is still shining through.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Felicia George about her book, When Detroit Play the Numbers. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you're with us. We've also got Felicia George with us. She's a professor of anthropology at Wayne State University and author of a book, When Detroit Played the Numbers. We're talking about the numbers game, what it meant in Detroit, what it meant economically, what it meant culturally, and what it means that it all went away. Felicia, speaking of that kind of cultural dynamic of it, dream books and the way that African Americans came up with their numbers. You know, there's so much about our culture that connects to the fantastic, and some people think that's weird. I always think that's worth celebrating and thinking about. But the numbers had an element of that.
Yes, it did. So I always tell people, people had their own methods for how they chose what numbers they were going to play. So you had people that, you know, had special dates, be it a birthday or anniversary, and they played that number. And then you would have hunch players that, you know, something was coincidental. Their total for their grocery bill was a number that really spoke to them, and so they played that number. But one of the ways that people really love to play numbers were dream books. And people say, what's a dream book? Well, think of a dream book, if you don't know. It's like a dictionary where you look up a word and it corresponds to a number. Mm-hmm. And there are, I mean, many, many different dream books. And people go, well, how did the authors figure out what that number would play for? And nobody knows. And a lot of the dream books were, they had spiritual aspects to them where they would say, you know, they received inspiration from the Bible or from something that was very, very spiritual. And so this is how a dream book would work. So let's say you could actually have a real dream, or let's say you were walking down the street and you got splashed by a black car with a puddle of water. And you go, oh my goodness, this was a significant event for me today. So I'm going to look up black car and see what it plays for. And you would get a three-digit number, and that's what you would play it for. What was really interesting about dream books, no two were ever the same. Yeah. Nobody knew how they received the numbers. But my favorite dream book is the Three Wise Men. And the reason why is it was a Detroiter who came up with that dream book.
Wow.
He lived on Scotton, and his last name was Banks. And
my
he
goodness.
Came up with this dream book in the 30s, and he was very smart. He copyrighted his dream book.
Yeah, there you
and
go.
And what happened was the numbers men in the city of Detroit copied his dream books and gave it out to the people that were playing. And he found out about it, so he sued all of them.
And got money.
And got money. And so these dream books, they are very special to people, so much so that the writers a lot of time memorize these dream books.
Yeah.
So that if you didn't have a dream book, you could ask your writer, you know what, I had a dream about fish. What does fish play for? And they would be able to tell you right off the top of their head what fish played for.
Right. You know, when you think about all of those kinds of things in black culture, I mean, they come from slavery.
Yes.
and the need for cultural connection and the need to make meaning out of difficulty, but also meaning out of hope, right? And I think that's one of the things that gets lost sometimes, is that even in really awful situations, there is a hopefulness about African Americans and African American people that perseveres.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that sense of hope is what really
and a
propelled.
A dream is by definition kind of hopeful. I mean, yes, it's gonna be a bad dreams too, but the word dream,
yeah,
and
as
the
you
association
interpret it, you know, and you're interpreting it for the better. But yeah.
When we think about the money, the economic system of the numbers, and the fact that for African Americans, it goes away with the lottery. One logical question is, okay, all that money still exists in the economy, it's still changing hands. Where does it go?
Well, you know, the government.
It doesn't come back to the same community, clearly.
Well, they would argue that it would. So as we have probably seen commercials where they talk about the lottery benefits the school systems. And so
it's supposed
spread,
to.
Yes, it's
and
supposed to.
And it does.
To.
I mean, we can see some evidence.
But when
it's
spread across a whole state.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of watered down a little bit. It's not as concentrated as when the numbers men were forced to put that economic power back into a very small area. Mm-hmm. And so you could see the benefits so much more because it was concentrated and forced in that area versus now where it's spread over a whole state, many school systems.
Yeah.
And so it's doing its thing, but not as powerful in certain communities that before that money was really concentrated in that area.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds you a little bit of, or reminds me, I should say, of the conversation we're having about reparations. Mm-hmm. There are so many things that were taken from African Americans, sometimes through force, sometimes through legislation. In this case, it's an economic taking, mm-hmm. right? And I guess some people would say, well, it was illegal to begin with, so how could you make a legal claim to it?
Mm-hmm.
But the practical effect of this is important. And the fact that you lifted that economic activity out of a community mm-hmm. and didn't replace it seems worth discussing.
Yes. And, you know, it was devastating. I spoke a little bit earlier about one of the big numbers operator. His name was Everett Watson.
Mm-hmm.
And just this is an example to show how powerful that money was, how much it was needed, how it impacted the city and the history like you would not believe. So we all know that during one time point, we could only live in Black Bottom and shop in Paradise Valley. That was just it. You know, we had
right.
these pockets of the city of Detroit that, you know, Black people were forced to live at. And as the population was growing, you know, the housing was horrible in the city of Detroit. And there was no one out really trying to figure out what are we going to do to address this in the Black community.
Mm-hmm.
Other communities, other ethnic groups, you know, they had the freedom by just sheer because they were white, they could move wherever they wanted to.
Yeah.
We didn't have that freedom. And so Everett Watson made all this money. And what he did was he went and he started buying up houses and land. And he started building houses on the west side. And he, by doing that, by putting that economic, that concentrated economic wealth in an area, now provided housing to Black people who for a long time had nowhere to go. And so now you take something so powerful like that, something that benefited, you know, just basic human needs of being able to lay your head down somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you take that wealth out and it leaves a void. And it's a void that to this day still really has not been filled.
Yeah, yeah. So your work is in anthropology.
Yes.
Which I think is a really interesting way to think about things like this. It's not just, I mean, it is a form of history, but there's something more tactile or organic, I guess, that I think of when I think of anthropology. I mean, of course, I literally think of, you know, almost digging through history to find things. And so I would love to have you talk about, from an anthropologist standpoint, why this is interesting and significant, which I think is different than the way a historian might think of it. And also feel free to tell me that doesn't make sense if it doesn't, because I'm neither a historian nor an anthropologist.
No, it does.
This is just my impression of those things.
It does. Our you know, with anthropologists, our methods of how we study things, the things that we really look at, we care about culture. So we're really looking at all aspects of culture. We love the holistic perspective where we're taking bits and pieces and we're putting this puzzle together. One of the big things, and you hear me say it a few times, talking about reciprocity.
Uh-huh.
Reciprocity is a major factor that we look at in anthropology. We look and say, what is it that makes someone feel obligated or want to return a gift to somebody?
Mm-hmm.
You hear me talk about race. Race is a huge part of what anthropologists study because race really impacts our world and our society. You hear me talk about the formal versus the informal economy.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, something that we really, really look at. One of the things that you hear a lot of people criticizing the numbers in the lottery, it's not rational. Well, anthropologists, we like looking at what is rational and what someone considers rational or not.
Right.
And so all of those little areas.
So what about the numbers to you? If somebody says it's not rational, how would you say that it is?
I would say not rational based on what? based on your ethnocentric view, right, based on what your value system is? How can I tell someone who, for a penny, for just a penny or a nickel,
yeah,
they have hope that gets them through the day?
Right.
So joy. How can I tell them that, right, that's not rational? How, wow, can I say it's not okay for you to have entertainment because you're deemed poor, but because I have money, I can rationally spend it however I want to.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's the same thing as entertainment. And so how can I say it's not rational when you have these people putting money back into the community, building the community up? And so there are a lot of aspects about it that screams this is rational.
This is rational. It depends on how you're defining,
yes,
defining rational. What are we supposed to think about all of this? And what is it that we should be looking for in terms of things like reciprocity, super powerful word, kind of walks alongside reparations in some, yes, ways. How should we be thinking about that?
You know, it's kind of weird when you sit there and you think about it, because today is so different than it was in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and 50s. Mm-hmm. But there are so many different avenues you can look at. You can look at, you know, we talked a little bit about the legalization of marijuana and what is that going to look like? And what role is reciprocity going to take in that?
How do you make sure we participate?
Yes, that we are sitting at the table,
yeah,
as active members and not on the fringes.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that look like? Even to this day, I even say with the lottery, how does that really, have we really made sure that, you know, this is a game that came from this community? How is it that it has benefited the community? How do we, you know, even today, how do we make sure that once again, we are still very much a part of the process? Because we're not. I mean, it's very, very different. You think about where the lottery agents are, who owns them. And so just going along those lines, you sit back and you say there's so many new avenues that are coming out, be it, you know, hip hop, music, whatever. Mm-hmm. That word reciprocity fits in all of that as we're watching, you know, other ethnic groups, you know, taking on this. What do we do to make sure that we are not leaving anyone behind?
Leaving anyone behind, yeah. I mean, you mentioned the lottery, which I think most people think of as a kind of perfected system, right? Mm-hmm. It works and everyone buys their tickets and you win or you don't, and the money from it does support schools and some other things that are important. I'm not sure anyone ever stops to think, well, this came from somewhere else, came from a people, and we took it from them.
Right.
And what are we supposed to do to
make sure
that
we're aware?
Should we be thinking about how the lottery might be structured, yeah, in a way that might
be? You know, and I've always, you know, throwing this out, what would that look like?
Yeah,
and
I'm just right,
like,
you what know, would that look
yeah,
like?
What would it look like? Is it something that I think needs to be done? Absolutely, it does. But to this day, you know, I don't have that answer to what it looks
yeah,
like.
Right. But the fact that we're not talking about mm-hmm. it, I think, is the thing that's really indicative.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, Felicia George, this was wonderful.
Thank you.
And
thank
the book,
so
of course,
much.
Is wonderful. When Detroit Played the Numbers. Thank you so much for joining us on Created Equal.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So, Carrie, one of the things I loved about that conversation was the discussion about how this connects to other ethnic communities in Detroit and presumably around the country who also got locked out of things and had to figure things out and actually came to the Black community to borrow a little bit of what was being done in the numbers. It's a really wonderful kind of wrinkle to our history that Felicia George of Wayne State University demonstrated so well in the book.
I mean, for me, and when Felicia, and this was not in the conversation, when she showed us that book, the dream book.
The dream
learning
book.
About the dream book and what that means. This is a scam like I ain't ever seen.
You say it's a scam. I say it's just part of, it's part of the culture. Think of the things that dreams mean to Black people and the way that hope plays on. You think I'm sugarcoating
it? Making it sound like I could take a book and write down some words and three numbers next to it and sell
you
it.
You could.
Well,
you
not
could.
Now. Not now. But at that time, I'm sure that's what they were doing.
But do you
doing.
Think it was being done cynically? Or do you think it really was to give people an idea that, hey, there's a hope element to this. There's a dream behind all of
these
things.
We need people in this world that interpret things like that the way you do, Stephen.
I'm always trying to give people the benefit of the doubt, right?
That's a good way to make a buck.
At least
it was more distributed than the lottery is.
Right.
Now.
Well, and that's the thing, right? That's a great example of how the numbers didn't just benefit the people who owned, quote-unquote, right. the numbers. There were all kinds of people who figured out ways to make money. My kids are too young to have any real memory of it, but for me, it's not that distant.
It's definitely a book I want to get and share. So
yeah, and definitely. It comes out soon. Yeah.
Comes out soon. March 26th.
March 26th.
All right, we put pressure on her now by saying that. Now if it doesn't come out.
That'll do it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org. And of course, make sure to subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our sound editing is by Connor Anderson. And our music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital team is Jenny Sherman, Dave Kim, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, Detroit's public radio.